Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Terry Madonna. I'm filling in for the vacationing Scott Lamar. Well, we have quite a program this morning. We're going to hear from the Pennsylvania Medical Society, from its president. We're going to talk about a number of things, vaccines, vaccinations among them. And then we're going to get into the census, big debate over it. We're going to get into some detail covering the census. But first, we have one of Pennsylvania's two United States senators on the phone with us to say, to talk about a variety of things. Good morning, Senator Bob Casey.
Hey, Terry, great to be with you.
Well, listen, Senator, we got a whole bunch of things to talk about and limited time to do it. But the first thing I want to ask you about is I want to get to your trip to the border, the Mexico-United States border. I mean, it literally, when you read all these reports from a variety of people, whether it's reporters or Republicans or Democrats who go, your colleagues in the Senate and in the House, you get a wide variety of viewpoints about what is going on there. You recently visited the border. Give us your impression. What did you learn? Did anything change in terms of how you view the situation at the border, which is complex, complicated, and quite important?
Yeah, Terry, thanks for asking. It was eye-opening, and it was disturbing, and it was also, of course, educational. We were there on Friday. I was there with 12 other senators, and that's one of the biggest delegations, I think, to go that was just from one chamber. Sometimes you've had House delegations that were large, and they would sometimes together. But what we tried to do there was to try to get to as many places in a day. We ended up going to four different locations. All four were of a different variety. The first place we went had families that were just recently arrived, more like an intake center where they're just being processed and then they're held there for a period of time. That was the newest facility, I think, on the border, certainly the newest facility in that area. And the area was generally around McAllen, Texas, in the Rio Grande River area. And that was, the first one had a very large fortified tent. I mean, a tent which would be the size of maybe a few blocks. And that seemed to have all of the things that people have been calling for pursuant to these inspector general reports that were devastating, where people were, where there was too much overcrowding, people were not given showers sometimes for days or weeks, all kinds of problems with how they dealt with children. So that Sure. center seemed to be, for the whole day, the most modern or up-to-date. The places where they kept the families, the rooms, were very large and spacious, and they had a lot more showers, for example. That's one basic indicator of the care. And they seem to have a good medical team there, but it's hard to evaluate when you're just doing a quick tour, and I'm not a doctor. And then the second stop we made was at Catholic Relief Services location, which Catholic Relief Services work closely with Homeland Security. And of course, because it's a welcoming place, it was very clear to me that the migrants who arrive there are given not just a shower and clean clothes, but they're fed. They're only there though for about a day and a half.
Sure.
So that's a short stop. And then the last two were the most disturbing and frankly depressing. One was the McAllen Border Patrol Station, where you had, in the indoor part of it, where you had these men crowded into these very small rooms, a room the size of maybe your living room in your home, and crowded together and with a glass enclosed room. And of course, you can't hear them, but they're obviously in tough shape, and they're crowded together. I think the overcrowding was reduced because the inspector general's report was so critical. Then the very last one, I'll wrap up with this, was a place where they had the children and families in the so-called cages. That seems that the overcrowding there seemed pretty bad, although I think the Homeland Security, and we were with the Secretary of Homeland Security who traveled with us, they seem to be making great, or at least asserting over and over again to take or to try to convince members of Congress that they're taking to heart these recommendations and criticisms right. in the Inspector right. General's report or by sure. members of Congress.
Look, we welcome your questions and comments. I'm chatting with U.S. Senator Bob Casey. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or shoot an email to us at to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, and we're also on Twitter, smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number is 1-800-729-7532. I'm chatting with U.S. Senator Bob Casey. Senator Casey served also as our state's auditor general and as state treasurer. He was elected recently to a third term, right? It's hard to believe already. A third term. At any rate, is the question here, I'll put it this way. It seems like when we get a record number of people crossing the border, and for a long time, there's been inadequate funding. Now, you all in Congress took care of that with a large appropriation a couple of weeks ago. What's at heart? What is your sense after your visit about the heart of the problem? Is it a combination of things? Weigh in on that.
Well, I think the policy by the president, and look, I think sometimes people in Washington paint with a broad brush as it relates to Border Patrol and, right. and ICE and other and Health and Human Services. They're the major agencies dealing with this issue. Sometimes people say, "Oh, they're all bad, or they do this. Everything they do is wrong." The people who work in those places, for the most part, some of them are obviously the record indicates by Facebook posts and other things, are bad people and shouldn't be working there. But a lot of the people that do work there do a good job and try to do everything they can. The problem is the policy at the top is bad, and combined with the rhetoric of the president. When you have a president who keeps sending the message over and over again, almost every day, that he doesn't want immigrants coming to this country. He wants to just keep them out, and uses kind of smearing and denigrating language about immigrants and migrants. You're going to have a bigger problem. What we should do is say, we're a great country and we know how to deal with this. We're going to deal with this in a rational way. We're going to make sure that when immigrants come to our country, that they're welcome, but they have to go through a process.
Sure.
And we're going to make sure that when people are seeking asylum, that we're going to give them what America has always given them, due process and a chance to make their claim. Most of their claims will fail. They will not be successful. But we know that if you give them an opportunity
right.
to make their claim, that we can have a rational system, we can keep the border secure, we can deal with folks humanely, and that's why you need a comprehensive immigration bill, and we need to improve our asylum system, not make it harder for people to seek asylum.
Well, believe it, we have a couple of phone calls. We have Heather from West Hanover. Heather, go ahead.
Hi, I'm a business owner in the construction industry. We need these people. We need them. You know what? They're some of the hardest working people you'll ever meet. I often say, you know what? We have so many people out here that don't want to work and are fully capable of working but choose not to. You can't get them to show up on time. You can't get them to pass a drug screen. We have this problem in the construction industry. We need to treat them the way we treat people like where we had Katrina, where you had people that were homeless and they were Americans and we were finding places for them to live. Every industry up here needs them, and they're hard workers, and I'm tired of the propaganda making it sound like they're these criminals and they're just taking advantage of the system and blah, blah, blah. It's all a bunch of hoopla and lies, and we need them workers. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Heather. Senator?
Heather makes I'll tell you, Heather makes a great point. We need them for our workforce. Look at the agricultural community in Pennsylvania needs them. Mm-hmm. And that means that you can have a system that screens out the folks who are a problem. And, you know, we were pressing the Homeland Security Secretary because he and the Border Patrol Commissioner were saying, well, we have to deal with some who are coming across who have criminal records. And we said, well, how do you know that? And they said, well, we checked databases. We said, okay, when you add it all up, basically what's the number of all the people coming across the border? What's the number who have a criminal record? They said 4%. So one of the senators then said, so that means 96% of the people coming across have a criminal record. He said, that's right. Now, a criminal record could be something not violent, could be something, it could be a misdemeanor. But
sure,
if the problem is 4%, then we should treat the problem appropriately in proportion. And, Pat, look, the best thing, Terry, we ever did in the Senate on immigration in 50 years was pass the 2013 bill that got 68 votes.
Right.
We would have been 6 years into solving the problem and would have had more border security than President Trump ever asked for. And yet, in 2013, passed the House with 60, passed the Senate, 68 votes, died in the House, never got a vote.
Yeah. Hey, I'm stumbling here because there's so many subjects I want to get to, and we have so little time with you. You're a very busy guy. Is there one or two things that you would suggest that Congress do now to deal with the situation at the border?
Well, the first thing is you need to have the president work with folks in a bipartisan fashion. If he's just going to demonize immigrants and demonize Democrats or push them away, why doesn't he call a meeting at the White House and say, give me the 2013 bill and let's update it, tweak it, do whatever, and let's get that darn thing passed. And then tell me the best ways, bring in the group of experts on asylum, but what's the best way to improve our asylum system?
Right.
But he doesn't want to do that. So his administration has the pressure from him to keep people out almost no matter what, and the pressure from the rest of the world, meaning members of Congress and journalists who are investigating and lawyers who are advocating on behalf of these immigrants and migrants, saying we want to improve the system, and the administration is having to react to that. Now, some members of the administration are trying to make the system better, but the president undermines them every single day, in my judgment. And I think we need to sit down and work through immigration legislation and also an improvement for our asylum system. The $4.6 billion we sent, that just appropriated, is helping.
That's a big help.
The new facilities that will be built will help. I think a lot more help for children and having more input from pediatricians and experts.
Sure.
In terms of the care for children at the border is going to help a lot.
Before I let you go, I want to turn to health care. As you know, during the we were in the midst of a Big Democratic nomination battle for the presidency of the United States. Your party will nominate a candidate. Here's the question. Some of the major candidates want Medicare for all or a single payer. They would end private insurance for 180 million Americans. On the other hand, there are some Democrats running who say, nope, let's keep Medicare as it is and allow what they call a public option, meaning you could register and sign up and get your care through Medicare. Which, and as you know, Medicare for All, the price tag for that is somewhere, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, could be $25-30 trillion before it's all said and done. But what do you, first of all, what's the Bob Casey position on it? And secondly, what do you think's going to happen?
Yeah, Terry, very quickly, I think number one is I like the goal, but I don't like the pathway. The goal meaning let's get everybody covered because we're still not there yet. But the pathway, I think, that's will get enough support to pass, and nor would folks, I think, embrace the idea, because the idea of saying to 150-plus million Americans, we're going to take away that employer coverage you have, which you generally like, although you want to bring costs down, you want to bring prescription drug costs down, but you generally like it, we're going to take it away and give you this government card. I just don't think that's going to fly with people. There are some other questions I have about how does it affect kids who are receiving Medicaid if that child has a disability? Though even the slightest change in a plan, let alone major change, is difficult for families that have a loved one with a disability, especially a child. We need to keep Medicaid in place.
Right.
And that's where we have to stop the fights from the funding battles to make sure it doesn't get gutted. I think the important thing for Democrats is to stay on the attack, because Republicans in the Congress are trying to cut the Medicaid program by $1.5 trillion the next decade, and they're trying to cut Medicare at the same time. They support a lawsuit that will devastate the whole system.
Right.
And Medicaid expansion, by the way, which is how we treat the opioid crisis. So we have enough to do just fighting off Republican attempts to gut the whole system.
Yeah.
And I think we should, I think the public option makes sense. Some people believe you should put Medicaid on the exchanges. That's not a bad idea. Medicare at 50. Maybe you give parents an option. If you want your child to be enrolled in Medicaid at birth, that's a pretty damn good option for kids.
Well, last year in the 2018 midterm election, health care emerged as the most significant issue. It trades places with a subject we were just talking about, immigration and health care immigration. Mm-hmm. But a couple of the issues that the voters really paid attention to and weighed in on was the cost of prescription drugs and coverage for pre-existing conditions. They seem to be two aspects that dominated much of the discussion. What's your sense about that?
Well, on prescription drugs, we may have an opportunity this week in the Senate Finance Committee to vote on a measure which will bring down some of those costs for some Americans. Not enough. It won't be the solution that everyone will want, and I'm still looking at the proposals myself, but it might be a step in the right direction, but not a real giant step. But there is tremendous pressure on Democrats, Republicans, House, Senate, and the administration to deal with prescription drug costs. We got to get them down.
Yeah.
And second, on pre-existing conditions, The reason why the lawsuit is so relevant is that if that lawsuit is successful, and it was successful at the trial level, they had oral arguments in the appellate court, the Fifth Circuit, that decision could be this fall.
Sure.
And in essence, you could have a court decision which ends the Affordable Care Act, which means that those protections for pre-existing conditions upon implementation of the court ruling would go away. Yeah. And Republicans in Congress have not a single piece of legislation to replace it. So it is, that lawsuit is every bit as threatening, if not more so, than the repeal effort of 2017.
Well, Senator Casey, I want to thank you for taking time. I know you have a busy schedule. You had a very busy week last week with your travels, and thanks for coming on the program, and thanks what you do for the state.
Terry, thank you very much, and thanks for providing the opportunity.
My pleasure. All right, you're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Terry Madonna. All right, well, we're delighted to have as our guest right now Dr. Danai Powers. She's an anesthesiologist, lives in State College, Pennsylvania. Importantly, she's the president of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. She's a board-certified anesthesiologist. She works at Penn Highlights Hospital System and provides anesthesia services for rural, independent, physician-owned surgery centers. Dr. Powers, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Terry, and thank you for having me.
Oh, no, I'm delighted. You and I have chatted previously. I'm really sort of fascinated with this whole discussion about vaccines and vaccinations and the fact that there's been a decline in folks who are getting vaccinated and whose children are getting vaccinated. And as you and I chatted earlier, can I call it a crisis? Is that too strong a word to describe the situation if these vaccinations aren't enacted?
I do not think that is too strong a word. Vaccines are very important for both the health of individuals and of community at large. And if vaccination rates fall, the risks of seeing the complications of some of these devastating diseases coming back goes up.
Yeah, well, talk about I mean, we've got measles. I can go through a whole, you can do it right. Better than I can, a whole bunch of other, and they just spread like wildfire. And you and I also chatted about that. Give us a couple of examples of if vaccinations aren't conducted regularly, with a couple of possibilities that could spread some diseases.
Well, as we had discussed, the diseases that vaccines were invented for were diseases that were felt to be significant public health risks. They not only spread rapidly, they had a very high infectivity rate, so that, for instance, a person with measles could go into a room of 10 right. people, 9 out of 10 of them were going to come down with measles, and that just perpetuated. And then these diseases also had significant impacts on the individual in terms of health, long-term outcomes. Some of them were associated with blindness, with deafness, with meningitis, and with pneumonias, with high fevers, and in a number of these diseases, people could die, children could die. So there was a push over decades in the last century to develop treatments for these problems, and vaccines were an extremely effective method of preventing the diseases because they harnessed the power of the individual's immune system and weaponized every patient to be able to respond should they get exposed.
Right.
And not only did that help the child and the patient, but it also kept the disease from perpetuating itself throughout a community. And we take for granted, I think, some of the health that we see now in our communities. I think we have forgotten what used to happen.
Yeah, there's a bill in the state legislature, Senate Bill 653, if I got the number correct, and that would eliminate the state's religious and philosophical exemptions for student vaccinations. The PA Medical Society supports that. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Our members have discussed this at length, and the feeling has been that we do need to do everything we can to get every child vaccinated if it is safe for them to be vaccinated.
And so how important is that when people say, well, I'm opposed to it for A, B, and C, or I have a religious concern, that should be overridden by a state law? I mean, would you argue that the health concerns are so great that it needs to override those convictions?
Well, the medical society has that position.
Right.
Our position is that the science to date is pretty clear on the safety of these vaccines. We have clear indications of patients that can't get them for medical reasons. But if those contraindications don't exist, these vaccines are extremely safe, and the benefit of getting vaccinated is very, very high. And so it can literally be a life-saving intervention. So the medical society, based on the science and the epidemiology of what we have been studying for years, has the position that, yes, all children should be vaccinated if they don't have contraindications from a medical standpoint.
Yeah, and there's another important bill that has been introduced. It's House Bill 286, and under this bill, physicians could not refuse to treat a child whose parent or guardian has chosen to delay or decline one or more of the vaccines or require them to sign a waiver as a condition for continuing to provide care. You have some concerns about that legislation.
Yeah, the medical society has the position that that is an ill-advised piece of legislation. First of all, it puts a physician in an untenable position to take care of a patient or a family where the patient or family is not accepting the advice coming from the physician. The other thing that happens is that a lot of these practices have individuals as other patients. For instance, in a busy pediatric practice, you may have a child that has cancer,
that is
immunocompromised, that cannot get vaccinated.
Yep.
To have that child in the same waiting room or office with an individual who isn't vaccinated and may carry a disease puts the child who could not be vaccinated at risk. And we feel that physicians should be allowed to make decisions looking not just at the individual patient, but at their practice as a whole about what makes sense for them to have in the population of patients that they are caring
right.
for.
Yeah, I'm chatting with Dr. Danai Power. She's the president of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. Of course, we welcome your questions and comments. You can call us at 1-800-729-7532 or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can also leave a question on WITF's Facebook page. And we are on Twitter as well at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number 1-800-729-7532. All right, let's go to another issue that I think is very, very important. And that has and the way that's positioned is it's referred to as prior authorization. That means that you as a physician would have to get approval from insurers, insurance companies, before prescribing medication or performing a test such as an MRI or moving forward with a specific treatment. So weigh in on your concerns about that.
Yeah, so what's happened with prior authorization is it has become a roadblock in many, many instances to patients getting timely, effective, and necessary care. And it has also become an impediment in a physician's practice. It's tying up large amounts of staff time, large amounts of the physician time. So it is cutting down on the time doctors and their office staff have to actually treat and deal with patients, as well as delaying necessary treatment for patients. And what we have seen is it has gone so far in the direction of intervening in basically all aspects of care that we find that patients are now being harmed because of the impediment that has been put in place.
Yeah, there's one survey result. 28% of doctors said that delays from prior authorization have led to serious adverse events for their patients. And that was a survey done by the American Medical Association, correct?
Correct, yeah. And that survey that came out last year has documented how serious this issue has become. And we really need to see something done to unwind the power that prior authorization now holds and the interference it has given for patient care. For instance, one of the things that prior authorization can do is we call it fail first. So a patient comes, has a disease. Let's say it's cancer.
Right.
They say you can't go to the drug that the doctor and the patient may feel would be best indicated for that individual. Prior authorization will require them to work through a series of steps. What if the drug that is mandated by prior authorization, the doctor knows isn't going to work? You're subjecting a cancer patient to a treatment that isn't going to work and has to fail first before you're allowed to move on to what you know will work. That is tragic. I mean, that's a level of interference that can be life-threatening, not to mention the stress and anxiety. And we see this repeating itself in many different instances. There are some instances where drugs that do work are taken away. The patient has to go back to another drug because there's been a change in the insurance policy. By removing the first drug, it becomes ineffective. And what you've basically done is removed a treatment option for that patient. So these are the things we need to have legislators understand. We've got to do something to improve what is currently going on.
You know what's really fascinating about this and important is that the subjects we're talking about don't get a lot. The vaccine question has really come up, and it's been big in the press in the last year or so.
Right.
But there's a whole series of situations involving the medical community and patients that don't seem to get a lot of attention. And I'm delighted that we have you to weigh in on them. Before I let you go, give me one other sort of big issue that the medical community faces that might require, legislative action out of either in Harrisburg or in Congress or something else that the medical society thinks is extremely important to resolve.
There's a lot of issues out there. One is team-based medical care. Another one that came up when you were talking with Senator Casey is about drug pricing.
Right.
We feel that some of the middlemen involved in the drug situation are unnecessarily driving up costs, and that needs to be looked at. We have issues related to the opioid use disorder crisis that we're facing. We have issues related to insurance payments and what's called surprise billing. I mean, there's a multiplicity of issues
right.
that the medical society is dealing with, and I just appreciate you giving us an opportunity to put
No,
some
it's
of
important.
Them out.
It's important subjects. More and more, as I indicated to Senator Casey, this cost of prescription drugs. I mean, it's something, you know, on the one hand, you look at, well, how much regulation do we want? Is that really something that ought to be done and done routinely? How important is that? On the other hand, you as a physician have to prescribe the appropriate drug. And if it works and you know it's going to be successful, the cost, you know, what you can't prescribe it and say, well, I'm not going to prescribe it because it's too expensive, if in fact it's the drug that works.
And in addition, if the cost is being driven by middlemen who don't have to be in the equation.
Right.
That's another issue. And then we see these drug shortages that are sweeping across the country periodically. And just last year, we had a shortage of all things saline, IV solutions. And this is all in part because of a process that has too many middlemen in the system, and
yeah.
it's not as clear as it should be. So there's a lot of issues that I think the legislators are looking at, and we're hoping that our input and shows like this are going to help put some light on what really where the solutions lie.
Yeah, well, I mean, when you get down to talking about prescription drugs, you really are in many respects at the heart of the needs
yeah.
that many patients have. Of course, given what you do, I don't have to remind you of that. But it seems to me that, and along, as I mentioned to Senator Casey, this pre-existing condition problem and the fact that people are going to come into a physician's office with a pre-existing condition that's probably more common than we would think, and how that gets taken care of with insurance is extremely important.
Well, the medical society, I can tell you, believes that pre-existing conditions need to be covered. I mean, we're talking about people's health, and you can't say, well, you have a problem, but this year we're not going to deal with it. Yeah, so pre-existing conditions, no matter what solutions are out there, there needs to be a mechanism so that people can get health care. Yeah.
Before I let you go, one other question. Let's talk briefly about the concern that we have enough physicians, particularly in certain specialty areas. I hear that from time to time from doctors that I know. Is that a huge issue, a minor issue? How would you define that?
Well, are you talking about in terms of doctors choosing specialties like primary care versus, for instance, orthopedics?
Yeah.
Or the actual numbers? Well,
about both?
Okay. In terms of actual numbers, we are being told there's a physician shortage, but I'm going to go back to something we just talked about, prior authorization. The AMA study showed that the average physician spent 15 hours a week on prior authorizations. How many patients could that doctor see if they weren't spending close to 2 days dealing with prior authorizations? So part of the physician shortage issue is physicians have been burdened with regulations that impede their access to spend their time taking care of patients. Then we have the second issue, which is specialties that physicians are going into. I think that it's been pretty clear that primary care, internal medicine, pediatrics are extremely important practices that need qualified physicians working in them because they are kind of the coordinators of care between the patient and all the specialists. And what we have happening in this country is that those, unfortunately, are some of the lower paid professions, and our youngsters are coming, and they're all young to me now, the young people coming out of medical school, some of them have debt as high as $300,000.
Mm.
So you tell a person that you want them to go into one of the lowest paid practices, but they have a debt that is going to take them years to pay off. So we really have to look at what we're doing financially to incentivize physicians to go into the specialties that we need. I think what happened at New York Medical, Langone Medical School, where they said all tuition is free. I mean, that's huge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to really allow a lot of these young, motivated physicians coming out to say, I want to go into a primary care specialty. I want to go into rural Pennsylvania. I want to work with telemedicine. I want to be at the forefront of the first interaction with patients, and I don't have to worry about paying off $300,000. So people are working on this, and I'm hoping that as we move into the future, things are going to get better.
Well, Dr. Powers, I want to thank you. This is a very important update, and thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Terry. Have a good day.
You too. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Terry Madonna. Well, welcome back to Smart Talk. I'm Terry Madonna, sitting in for a vacationing Scott Lamar. Well, now we're going to turn to a completely different subject, and it has to do with the census, and it's been in the news considerably, I'd say, in the last couple of months. We're chatting with with Micah Sims. He heads Common Cause. You're not a doctor, are you, Micah?
No, not that type of doctor. I am pursuing my doctorate in ministry, but not a doctor.
Hey, good
like
for
that.
You. Good for you. And Katie Meyer is sitting right next to me. She's the WITF Capitol Bureau Chief. She'll be joining in on the question. So let's just start out with a basic question. And I know this may sound very simplistic, but let's start simple. What's the census?
The census is, by U.S. Constitution, something that happens every 10 years by which every person in the United States must be counted. We count it for reasons of representation. We've now gone further to gather that information for reasons of resources, federal funding that will come and that is allocated to the various states. And so that is basically what the census is. We need to make sure that everyone tells us where they are on April 1st in this country so that we can make sure we've got a complete and accurate count of the number of individuals in the United States.
Yeah. And there's also a funding component of this as well. Hi, Micah, by the way. We've talked a lot about this over the last couple of months.
Right. But
just for, you know, background's sake, we haven't always funded the census on the state level. It's a federally funded project. A couple of years ago, back under Governor Tom Ridge, he put about $300,000 in on the state level for census efforts. Ed Rendell, Ridge was a Republican, Rendell's a Democrat. He started using some money from state agencies to support the count. But this year, Micah, you guys at Complete Count, which is a commission the Governor Tom Wolf established, you guys asked for, I believe, $12.8 million, which is a dollar for every Pennsylvanian. Why did you think that this year, why did you think we needed a little bit more money?
So, Katie, you started out well, that the census is generally a federally funded operation.
Sure.
Unfortunately, this administration slashed funding for census almost in half. Therefore, it left a number of advocates, government officials worried about how we were going to make sure that the information, the outreach, the engagement was going to happen around the census. Mm-hmm. Just for an example, before in 2010, we had nine regional offices. This time we'll have four. Mm-hmm. So that's just an idea of the massive cut that has happened at the federal government level. I know we've been lobbying up on the Hill, Common Cause, and other organizations for more funding in this upcoming appropriation, but it's still not there yet. And so when states saw that there was going to be a slash of funding at the federal level, a number of states went to deciding we needed to put our own money in. And Katie, you raised a great point. Remember, there is federal funding that is associated with census count. And so an investment by a state basically is assuring them that they're going to get the allocated resources that are necessary. Because when you don't get those resources from the federal level, you then at the state and even sometimes at the local level have to figure out how to offset that.
Mm-hmm. Well, on the funding, sorry, Terry, did you have something you wanted to say?
No, I just want to tell if people want to call in, 1-800-729-7532 or shoot us an email at smarttalk@witf.org. We'd like to hear from you. Take it, Katie. Take it.
Yeah, well, absolutely. We'd love to hear from you. And then, Micah, so you mentioned you wanted this funding. You wanted that $12.8 million. You didn't get it from the legislature, did you?
No, we did not. I think there obviously, the budget always goes through a lot of gyrations, as all three of us know, and as most Pennsylvanians know. We made a really assertive effort to make that pitch to the legislature through the Census Complete Count commissioners and other organizations, but it seemingly fell on deaf ears. It was unfortunate because, again, what we said was just invest $1 in every person, and that is basically, if you look at statistics and reports done, brings back about $2,083 per person. And so that's $20,000 in federal funding over the 10 years of the decade. And so just making that simple investment ensures that type of money. It didn't happen. Mm-hmm. Fell on deaf ears. But we are hopeful now that a number of of other elected officials have reached out and said they have concerns, rural communities have concerns, urban communities have concerns, that maybe something might happen very soon in reference to trying to find some allocation of public funds to help with census outreach.
Hey, before we get into questions like how is the census conducted and what data is collected, we simply have to go to an important area of concern, and that has to do with the question of whether there should be a citizenship question on the census. That question did appear until the Obama administration, when they removed it from the census. As you know, the Supreme Court said, no, you can't be asked. That question cannot be put into the census. President Trump said, okay, we're going to get that information another way by having every federal agency that deals with individuals, and that's virtually all of them, they have to provide information to the Commerce Department about, you know, the census and about the people who are not citizens. Mm-hmm. So what's your sense about where all that goes? And I'll ask you the hard question. Should it be asked or not asked?
So Terry, let me just back up and try to provide some clarity on something you said. The citizenship question has not appeared on the census, the decennial census, for over 50 years. And so when the current administration went to inject it and place this on the census, it obviously raised a number of concerns because, again, the Constitution asks that all individuals are counted during the census.
All individuals.
All individuals. That's by the Constitution. And so what it did was raise a red flag with a number of immigrants that were here in the country, and even concerns about people who were being naturalized. Just people who were concerned. I think both Katie and all of us can agree there is a lack of trust in government that exists within our culture right now. And so any concerns that are raised by the government causes some sort of backlash. And so putting the citizenship question or offering to put the citizenship question on the census caused some major concerns. And we felt that this could really generate a very low response rate to the census,
right?
Because there are people who just don't trust the government. And remember,
I'll tell you, Micah, I'll tell you something. What's surprising is that there have been multiple news reports that that question was on the census and removed by the Obama administration. I want to thank you for providing this correction. Go ahead, finish your thought there.
Yeah, and so and with the new wave or the new alliteration of the census, this is the first time in our history that the census will be has an option to be done online.
Right.
We already know how people feel, good or bad or indifferent, about the internet, and now you've got census information that is going to be displayed, done on the internet. And so with this new alliteration, then you've got this potential of a citizenship question. It just raised a lot of red flags, concerns, and again, why a number of us really got on the bandwagon early to make sure that we did everything possible to make sure there is no undercount that happens in Pennsylvania.
Right.
Yeah, and on the citizenship question, just briefly, I think the way the conflict there has been framed to me, and you know, and it makes sense to me in this format, is the census, as Micah said, it's supposed to count everyone. And that means whether or not they are a citizen, they should be counted, because the census is used in large part to allocate federal funds
money
to things like roads and bridges,
right,
and, you know, federal programs that you can use whether or not you're a citizen. So the question becomes, if there's an area in which there are a lot of undocumented immigrants, for instance, and there's a, you know, they're supposed to be counted, they're supposed to respond to the census, and they see a citizenship question on there, the concern is that people will get nervous and they'll think it's going to be used against them.
Yep.
But and any case. So the citizenship question is probably not going to be on the census unless something radical changes.
Right.
But now, Micah, I did want to get back into, you said you aren't going to get that money that you need for the census, or that you wanted, rather, for the census on the state level. What's the alternative plan here? Are you going to look into seeing if the administration will transfer funds out of other departments? Are you going to look for a cheaper way to do the outreach you wanted to do?
Yeah, I think it's both and. We are talking to the administration again, about finding potential resources in certain departments. I recently have had some conversations with some senators who were part of a policy hearing. They really hear more information about the census because they wanted to make sure that the rural community of Pennsylvania was going to be represented and heard when it came to census outreach. And so now that we're grabbing everybody's attention and ear, Katie, I'm hopeful that not only will we have the administration help us, but also maybe the legislature might find its way to providing some sense of funding. Now, how that happens, I'm not sure, because remember, by the time we get through a budget next year, the census count really will be over. But I'm willing, and we're all willing, to find any conversation that could lead to additional funding.
Well, Michael, we have a call. Nancy from Greencastle is on the line. Nancy, welcome to Smart Talk.
Hi, how are you?
We're hanging in there, as they say.
I just heard that you talked a little bit about my concern, but I've never really heard about the citizen versus non-citizen really being an issue on the census before. But and the undocumented seems to be a real issue here. But who is around other than undocumented? I assume green cards and stuff like that. And what is the real monetary impact? I just heard you say roads and bridges and stuff, but is all federal funding apportioned according to the numbers of the count? And then, and I would assume that impacts schools and all that stuff. And then how many people or percentage are we really talking about that would be citizen versus non-citizen, you know, and not necessarily just undocumented?
All right, Micah, take it.
I think that's exactly why we have to do the census. I think we need to find out what that percentage is that would actually happen. Let me go to the caller's first thing, is that the answer is yes. The dollars that come from the federal government are based on every person. And as Katie lifted up, that funding that comes for schools and health care and everything is based upon per person, not per citizen. And so, again, when you don't have that federal funding coming in that matches the number of people, then states and townships and counties and cities are strapped with the necessity of filling in those holes. And so we've got to make sure that we're doing that. We don't want, Terry, the listeners to be uneducated. We know that the census operates really every year because there is the community survey. That's an opportunity by which the Federal Bureau finds out what's happening on a yearly basis. And that's possibly another way, and I know we've heard this before, a lot of ways we can find out citizens versus non-citizens. But when we're counting it as per Constitution every 10 years, we just need to count everybody, go from there, because the apportionment, the representation, the funding is all allocated based on those numbers.
And then, Micah, we've got about 4 minutes left here. You mentioned a couple of times here, you know, how many people are actually, you know, at risk for not being counted? What are those groups that you think are like particularly vulnerable?
So, obviously, the number one category are children under 5. Then you're dealing with seniors. Then you're also dealing with, obviously, as undocumented immigrants, minorities. Those are really the targeted areas. And the fifth one, I would say, is the rural community, because oftentimes, and particularly, again, we're doing this census, it's predominantly being looked at done online. The broadband issue comes in, the distance in between houses, et cetera. And so those are the areas that we really need to be concerned about, and this is why we were reaching out for the funding from the state level, and we won't stop until we get it done, and we'll figure out a way. We'll reach out to the philanthropy community some way. We'll see if we can get some dollars in here to help sure we don't have an undercount in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, one of the huge issues here has to do with redistricting, reapportionment, and that's why our, in particular, the political community pays a lot of attention to that, and it's part of the big debate, you know, in terms of who should be counted and how they should be counted and getting it accurate.
Sure, and that's all, but it's about political power as well. We've got about 30 seconds left here. It's about political power. Pennsylvania is almost certainly going to lose at least one congressional representative in the next census, so we're not on the edge. Some states are. So that's another reason why lots of people are looking at this census as being very important.
Yep,
All right. Now, Terry, I think we're just about done here, right?
Yep. We're out of time, and I want to thank you, Micah, for coming on. And
thanks for having me.
You're going to follow this very carefully.
Yes.
All right. On Tuesday, Smart Talk guest is host Valerie Pritchett is in the studio. She's going to talk about how schools are using therapy dogs to enrich student lives and for emotional support. So please tune in to Smart Talk on Tuesday.